We're operating under some time constraints. I want people to bear with us. George, we're supposed to have a tape by Naomi Prince. I'd like you to cue that. And if you're not ready, I'll do a, or are you ready? Very good. Let's do this right now. Do I need to introduce her? I suppose she should.
Hi, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to speak to you here today. It's really quite a great honor. I want to talk about a few things, one of which is the Glass-Steagall Act and what it meant to our country's history, why it was passed, how it helped, how the repeal of that act in 1999 has created a tremendously unstable environment for individuals at the hands of banking institutions, political alliances, governments, and central banks, and also how some of the remedies that have been proposed in the wake of the 2008 subprime crisis, including the Dodd-Frank Act and its allegedly most important component, the Volcker Rule, are really ineffective at combating this risk. And what we really need to do is go back to a time and go back to a policy and continue to use the real strength of the Glass-Steagall Act in a new Glass-Steagall Act in order for us to be safe going forward. And when I say us, I mean everybody in this room. I mean the population of the United States. I mean the populations throughout the globe. Because what we have today and what we've had in the wake of the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act is an environment where the largest banking institutions have been able to increase the concentration of their capital, of their influence, of their power. And this has been subsidized and substantiated by political forces within the White House, the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, governments throughout the world, in particular throughout Europe, the ECB, and it's something that we really need to contain and look forward to changing if we want to have more economic stability for the greater citizenry at large. So going back a little bit in time to how the Glass-Steagall Act came about. We had a major crash in 1929. It was the result of a tremendous amount of speculation and also rigging of markets by the larger financial institutions, as well as things called trusts, which were small components of these institutions that were set up in order to bet on trusts, in order to bet on various industries and collections of companies within those industries and so forth, as well as to make speculative bets on foreign bonds in foreign lands, as well as to make bets on the housing market, which is something that we've seen and been familiar with quite recently. A lot of also the activity that was done in particular by the big six banks at the time, which included National City Bank and First National Bank, which today we know as Citigroup, the Morgan Bank and the Chase Bank, which today we know as JP Morgan Chase, as well as two other big six banks, got together in the wake of the crash in 1929, which they had helped to perpetuate, and decided that they needed to save the markets as they were deteriorating very quickly. And the reason they wanted to save the markets was not because they wanted to protect the population at the time. It was because they wanted to protect themselves. But the way they chose to do that was to pony up $25 million each after only a 20-minute meeting that occurred at the Morgan Bank on Wall Street, on 23 Wall Street, which is catacorner from the New York Stock Exchange at the time. And after this 20-minute meeting, which was called together by a man named Thomas Lamont, who was a major banker at the time and the acting chairman of the Morgan Bank, these six bankers, they went out into the streets. The press heralded them as heroes who would save the day, and in particular heralded the Morgan Bank as an institution that would yet again save the economy from virtual catastrophe. It compared the decision that was made after that 20-minute meeting to something that had happened after the Panic of 1907, where J.P. Morgan, the patriarch of the Morgan Bank, had been called upon by President Teddy Roosevelt to save what was then a situation of deteriorating markets and of deposits being crushed and of citizens losing their money because of rigging of markets that had happened back then. So this was a repeat of something very similar. After the meeting, the decision was to buy up stocks, and the stocks that were bought were the ones in which the big six banks had the most interest, and that is what they did, and the market rose for a day, which was why the newspapers were so happy. It was why President Herbert Hoover at the time decided he might actually get reelected as opposed to face not just an election but also a bad historical legacy, and everybody was quite pleased with the results. Unfortunately, as we know, after the market rose after that day, after they put in money to buy those stocks, It crashed by 90% over the next few years. The country was thrown into a Great Depression. 25% of the individuals in the country were unemployed. There was a global depression that was ignited because of this. Foreclosures skyrocketed. Small businesses closed. Thousands of smaller banks closed. And the country was in very, very dire straits. Into that came President FDR, and something that's very interesting historically that I did not even know before I did my latest book, All the President's Bankers, in that FDR had friends, and they were bankers. And two of the friends that he had that were bankers were men named James Perkins, who ran the National City Bank after the crash in 1929, and also a man named Winthrop Aldrich, who happened to have been the son of Nelson Aldrich, who happened to have been a senator at the time that the Federal Reserve Act, or its precursor, was created at Jekyll Island in 1910. So these were men of pedigree, and these were men of power, these were men of wealth, and these were men who were friends of FDR. And even before the Glass-Steagall Act that we know today was passed in June of 1933 and signed into law, these men worked with FDR because they believed that if they separated their institutions that they were now running, their banks, their biggest banks, some of the biggest banks in the country at the time, from keeping deposits of individuals safe and divided from speculative activities and the creation of securities that could go sour very quickly and tank not only their banks, but the general economy, they believe those two things should be separate. And that was the theory behind the Glass-Steagall Act, is that if you separate risky endeavors and risky practices and concentration of that risk from individual deposits and loans, that you create a more stable banking system, you create a more stable financial market, you create a more stable population, you create a more stable economy. FDR believed that, and the bankers believe that. That's something we don't have today. So before the act was passed, Winthrop Aldrich, James Perkins, they had meetings in the first 10 days of FDR's administration in which they told FDR, they promised him they would separate their banks even before the legislation was passed. And that's why it was more than just legislation. It was a political financial alliance at the time. It was policy at the time to stabilize the economy, to stabilize the system so that everybody could benefit. And those men did benefit. Their legacies benefited. The National City Bank that was run by James Perkins, the Chase Bank that was run by Winthrop Aldrich, those banks exist today. But the Glass-Steagall Act at the time enabled them to grow in a more stable aspect. Winthrop Aldrich and James Perkins chose to keep the deposit-taking and the lending arms of their banks. They separated them before, as I said, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed. They promoted the Glass-Steagall Act. FDR promoted the Glass-Steagall Act. Congress, in a bipartisan fashion, passed unilaterally, enthusiastically, the Glass-Steagall Act. So it was very much a national platform on every level. What we've had since, and this started to a large extent in the late 70s and accelerated throughout the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and the ramifications through the second Bush administration, the Obama administration, is a disintegration of the ideal of that act, the idea that risky endeavors and deposits should be kept separate in order for stability to exist throughout. In the 80s, banks were allowed to merge across state lines. In the 90s, banks were allowed to increase their share of financial services by reintroducing insurance companies, brokerages, the ability to create securities that we now know today can be quite toxic, as well as ultimately to trade in derivatives and other types of more technologically complex, but nevertheless even more risky securities, all under one roof. And in 1999, under President Bill Clinton, in the end of the year, an act was passed, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, that summarily repealed all of the intent of the Glass-Steagall Act. And what it created in its wake was a free-for-all merging and concentration and consolidation of these largest banks into ever more powerful and influential entities, influential over our capital, influential over our economy, influential with respect to the White House. And this was not something that the bankers pushed on the White House. This is, we should realize this. This was something that Washington, under several administrations, under bipartisan leaderships throughout, under different types of Treasury secretaries that both came from the very same banking system that they were supposedly going to be in public office to watch over, they all collaborated to repeal this act. In 2002, 2003, 2004, when rates started to be very low and when subprime loans started to be offered, these banks that now had much more concentration over deposits, over insurance products, over brokerages, over asset management arms, were able to create securities out of a very small amount of loans, out of $500 billion worth of subprime loans extended to individuals. They were able to create a $14 trillion mountain of toxic assets. And they were able to leverage that mountain of $14 trillion to $140 trillion of risk by virtue of their codependencies of the Big Six banks, by virtue of the derivatives that were involved in the securities that were laced with these mortgages, and by all sorts of complex different types of financial engineering. As we know, that imploded in 2008, and the result of that implosion was not to chop off the arms of these banks. It was not to have men at the top of these banks like Winthrop Aldridge say, you know what, this was a bad idea. We screwed up our banks. We screwed up the markets. We screwed up people. We screwed up the economy. Let's separate. Let's go back to a time that wasn't simpler, but that was safer. That wasn't a decision that was made. What was made instead was a decision at the highest levels of Washington, the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, the New York Federal Reserve, to coddle this very banking system, to subsidize it, to sustain it in all its flaws, and with all the risks that it permeated around the entire population in the United States and throughout the world, with trillions of dollars of loans, of cheap money, of zero interest rate policy, which is now going into its fifth year of existence, which means these banks can continue to be liquid even though they are very unhealthy. A quantitative easing program, not just in the U.S. Federal Reserve, but now that is potentially going to grow in Europe as well, because those banks are also codependent on the U.S. banks, and because they are so unhealthy, they need institutions on the central banking level and in the U.S. government and in the Treasury departments and in Federal Reserves and other Treasury arms of different countries to sustain their activities, to back their bad bets, and to promote their interests over the interests of the wider stability of the population. The Graham-Dodd Act, the Dodd-Frank Act that was passed and signed into law by President Obama in July 2010 was said by President Obama, by then Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, by then Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, as well as many pundits in the media, was said to be the thing that would dial back this immense risk, that would get us back to the sweeping type of regulation that was like it had been in the Great Depression. But it has done absolutely nothing of the kind. In the wake of the 2008 crisis, the big banks are bigger. J.P. Morgan Chase was able to buy very cheaply Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual to become the largest bank in the United States again. This ties back to the legacy of J.P. Morgan in that 1907 panic, throughout the decisions that were made at its bequest in 1929, in the wake of 1929 crash, and so forth. Citigroup has managed to survive. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, all of these banks, the Big Six today, which are largely derivations of the Big Six banks historically 100 years ago, with a couple of additions and many mergers along the way, have been able to sustain themselves on the wake of government policy that has enabled them to grow and to sustain themselves and to continue to promote risky types of practices that can be very dangerous to all of us. The Dodd-Frank Act doesn't separate those banks. It doesn't make them smaller. It doesn't diffuse their derivatives concentration. The Big Six banks today in the United States control 96% of all the derivatives trading in the United States. They control 45% of all of the derivatives trading throughout the globe. They control 84% of the FDIC-insured deposits throughout all of the banks in the United States and 85% of the assets throughout all of the banks in the United States. So their concentration, their power is immense in the wake of the 2008 crisis, in the wake of this alleged remedy to the crisis, which is the Dodd-Frank Act. And the final component of that act, which was supposed to at least reduce their riskiest trading practices, what's called proprietary trading. The Volcker Rule is an 892-page rule with 55 pages of definitions and rule, and all of the rest exemptions to that rule. So the banks can continue to make markets, to hedge, to provide hedge funds and private equity funds just under different languages, to keep their insurance arms, to keep their brokerages, to be codependent, to create complex securities that are so interlocked that if one fails, the rest of them fails, and if the bank that had the most of them fails, the other banks in this entire system will fail as well. So nothing has been done in that language of the Volcker Rule, in the Dodd-Frank Act, to change anything. What we need is a resurrection of the Glass-Steagall Act. We need to realize it wasn't just a law. It was a policy of stability. It was a political and financial alliance between the White House and between the biggest bankers of the time and between the population. And that's what we need to have come back today. That's what we need to press. And that's the only thing, a complete separation of risky endeavors from our money, from normal lending practices, that can even start to foster a more stable financial system, banking system, and economic environment for all of the rest of us. And so that's the takeaway from what I wanted to tell you about today. There's more information about it historically, particularly the lead up to the Glass-Steagall Act that was passed, the swipes added over the time, the presidents that were stronger and the bankers that were stronger and caring about the population as well as the ones that didn't care at all about it with respect to financial stability at the hands of the banking system. And that can all be found in my book, All the President's Bankers, which I also urge you to check out, simply to get a more knowledge about the reasons for why we had that act and the reasons why it's more necessary than ever to resurrect it today. So thank you very much again for listening. Thank you for your time. And I hope the rest of the conference today is fantastic.